This week on the Best of Flashpoints, internationally renowned Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk comments on the prisoner exchange, the Iraq war, and the potential war against Iran. With major government mortgage corporations Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac teetering on the brink of disaster, and the Indy Mac Bank failing in California, a special edition of Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. Cynthia McKinney and her vice presidential running mate Rosa Clemente share their vision for a Green Party-controlled White House. All this with Dennis Bernstein coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we turn our attention again to the situation in Beirut, Lebanon. Yesterday was a troubling, if not historic, day. And Robert Fisk of the Independent of London writes in part, "Yesterday was the last day of the 2006 Lebanon War, the final chapter of Israel's folly and Hezbollah's hubris, a grisly day of corpse swapping and refrigerated body parts and coffin after bleak wooden coffin on trucks crossing the Israeli border, which left old Ali Ahmed al-Safir and his wife, Wadi, stooped and broken with grief." Robert Fisk joins us from Beirut, Lebanon. Robert, you were there covering this situation. Help us understand a little more of the history and what yesterday meant to both sides.
It was layered in history. What happened yesterday was that the Israelis handed over 200 bodies of Palestinians, members of the Hezbollah as well, who'd died either fighting the Israelis or being killed in air raids. They also handed over five prisoners, one of whom was a Lebanese who's been in prison for 29 years for the very brutal murder, not only of an Israeli policeman, but of a father and his young daughter. This was the price that Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel, paid for a box of body parts and the remains of two soldiers who were captured by the Hezbollah on July 12th, 2006. Humiliation for Israel, of course, because it handed over the last of its Lebanese prisoners and 200 corpses just for the bodies of two Israeli soldiers and a few bits of bodies of soldiers who were killed in the 2006 war, Israeli soldiers. The Hezbollah in Lebanon treated it as a celebration that they'd got what they wanted. They'd forced the Israelis to hand over living prisoners for dead bodies. The Israelis brought back the bodies of their two dead and therefore, of course, confirmed to their families. One of the soldiers had a young wife whose picture is seen grieving in all the Israeli papers today. It was a humiliation for the Israelis, of course. It was a humiliation for the Lebanese government, too, because this was a government supported by the United States. It was constantly referred to by the news agencies as the American-supported Lebanese government. A kiss of death, you might say, for an awful lot of Western, pro-Western governments in the Middle East. And yet at the airport, to greet the five living prisoners, four Hezbollah men and this man whose name was Kantar, who was in fact the murderer, convicted murderer, in prison for 29 years. And at Beirut Airport to meet them was the President of Lebanon, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, all the living ex-presidents of Lebanon, all the living ex-prime ministers of Lebanon, all the members of parliament who could be mustered together, the heads of the civil service, the heads of the security forces, a good many members of the security forces who were involved with the Syrians in the past. There was the presidential army band. The army actually flew the prisoners up to the airport. And there were all the pro-American members of the government of Lebanon groveling before the Hezbollah in receiving these five prisoners. It was pretty dramatic stuff. And in a way, you see, it also symbolized the return of Syria to Lebanon, something which I had seen only a couple of days earlier when I was in Paris watching the Bastille Day parades on July 14. And there beside President Sarkozy, only about four or five seats away from him, was President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. And indeed, when the president of Syria had private conversations with the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, Sarkozy did not once even bring up the UN Special Tribunal, which has been formed to find out who was responsible for the murder, along with 21 other people, of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in Beirut in 2005, on February 14th, 2005. So in many ways, what yesterday symbolized was indeed the end of the 2006 war, in which more than 1,000 civilians in Lebanon were killed by the Israelis. The Hezbollah killed about 160 Israelis, most of them soldiers. So yesterday symbolized the end of that war, but much more dramatically for the Lebanese, the fact that the Americans were not able to preserve the pro-Western government of Lebanon, and the Syrians are in effect back with considerable influence over the Lebanese.
Just another technical point on the, was this the end of 2006 war? We also know, Robert Fisk, that the Israelis littered the countryside of southern Lebanon with various kinds of munitions that are still killing people. So wouldn't you say the war in a way continues?
Well, most of those munitions have now been taken away. We've had 36 Lebanese killed since the war by those munitions. So the war, of course, for those people has continued and for Lebanon has continued. Most of those munitions have now been taken off the ground, mostly by Western NGOs. It's interesting that the Westerners make the weapons that the Israelis buy, then they go in afterwards to hoover them up after the Israelis have sprayed the countryside with these cluster bombs, particularly the Blue 85s. But in fact, if you're frank about it, most of these weapons have now been cleared up. What you do still have in southern Lebanon, of course, is the fear of a future Hezbollah-Israeli war, and everyone is talking about this. The Hezbollah themselves have withdrawn from the border area, where you now have 15,000 UN troops, most of them from NATO countries. The four UN generals are, in fact, all NATO generals in the south. So, of course, many Lebanese say this is another Western force, like the one in Iraq, like the one in Afghanistan, and so on and so forth. But you also have a situation where the Hezbollah are boasting of their victory in the next war. There's a very telling poster which you see as you approach the Nakura border post with Israel. Well, it's not a border that's open except for the United Nations. It's a big photograph of the Israeli warship that was struck by an Iranian missile in 2006. It caught fire. Four Israeli sailors were killed, and in fact, the vessel itself almost sank. And you can see it's a real photograph of the ship burning, and underneath the caption says in English, "And more to come."
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're delighted to be speaking with Robert Fisk. He is the award-winning Middle East correspondent of The Independent of London, author of The Great War for Civilization. All right, in terms of internal Lebanese politics, we've saw a pretty bloody shootout not too long ago. We saw some troubling military operations in the streets and in the countryside. What does that look like now?
Troubling, Dennis. They killer. Were real. 55 dead in one day.
Talk about where that led and where we are now in that situation.
Look, we were building up at that period, and we're talking about almost 3 months ago now. We were building up to a conflict, a violent physical military conflict between government forces, which of course are backed by the United States and the West, which were put into power with a democratic election. Not the prime minister, who was appointed. He never won any elections at all. But the government itself was democratically elected with a majority. And the minority opposition, which includes, of course, mostly the Shia groups, including the Hezbollah, who had two ministers in the government, who withdrew. For 18 months, we had a crisis here in which the Hezbollah and the other opposition groups insisted that they should have some power in the cabinet other than just a presence. And they said the minority should have a veto power over majority decisions. And this, following this crisis in the streets of Beirut, in which most of West Beirut was effectively taken over the Hezbollah and the Amal Shiite militia, the Shiites took over the western sector, the Muslim sector of Beirut, to the humiliation of the Sunni Muslims, who are not so numerous as the Shias, who are backed by the Saudis, therefore to the humiliation of Saudi Arabia as well. As a result of those battles and those very brutal killings that took part, in some cases it was the pro-government groups that did the most murderous of the killings. As a result of those battles, the peace agreement, if you want to call it that, which was signed in Doha, in Qatar, the state of Qatar, accepted that the opposition would have veto powers over the cabinet. So in effect, at that moment, that was the end of the pro-American government of Fuad Siniora. And Fuad Siniora was at the airport, as I said yesterday, to greet 5 prisoners, one of whom was a convicted murderer. And that shows you how everything has changed. The Syrian army has not come back. It's not going to come back. They don't need a Syrian army here. But the Syrian influence on Lebanon has been considerably reinforced, and the American influence has been considerably reduced. And indeed, if you look at the catastrophe, the hell disaster in Iraq, the catastrophe in Afghanistan, the collapse of state power in many areas on the northwest frontier, Balochistan areas of Pakistan, if you look at the fact that Gaza is totally in the hands of Hamas, if you look at the fact that Lebanon itself is now outside the influence of the United States, you see the enormous weakening of American power and prestige in the region, and of course the price that the Arabs who have supported or been supported by America, people like the government of Lebanon, people who have become loyal to the United States, like Walid Jumblatt, who had been extremely accusatory against the Syrians for murdering his own father back in the 1970s. These people are paying the price for accepting the support of America. At the end of the day, America has lost.
Let's move out into the larger region. You alluded to a number of important issues. Let's start with Syria. Israel recently bombed Syria. There's been leaks or rumors that they hit a nuclear plant. You've been looking into this. What did you find out about that bombing, and what do you think that was about?
Well, look, I questioned at great length Walid Mualem in Paris 2 days ago about that particular
target. That's the foreign minister from Syria.
The Syrian foreign minister, that's correct. Now, he said to me that it was a military position, but he said it wasn't nuclear. If it had been nuclear and was bombed, there would be radiation. There was no radiation. He said, do you really think we would allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to come to Syria to inspect it if it was a nuclear position? He didn't mention, of course, that the site had been bulldozed after the bombing, but having said that, of course, there's no particular reason to think that this was an up-and-running nuclear facility in the form that there might soon be, or indeed is to some extent, inside Iran. So I'm not greatly taken by the idea that Syria was about to produce nuclear weapons. Remember, we've got to go back and remember and have a certain recall of how all the Western papers, particularly the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, were banging the drum about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be non-existent. Now, if you read the American press, with their constant references and sourcing to American officials say, American intelligence officials say, Department of State officials say, the story is identical, except they're now either about Syria, which doesn't appear to have a nuclear facility, or about Iran. The same stories, in some cases written by the same reporters, not Judith Miller, of course, because she's left the New York Times. That's the one change we've had in journalism, and the only change in U.S. journalism since the lies that the New York Times was pumping out prior to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And, you know, I don't frankly believe it. One of the whole issues about Iran that we forget is that we're allowing the presidents and the prime ministers of our countries, and alas, the Tom Friedmans and the journalists in our countries, to set the narrative of this story. The real story of Iranian nuclear power is that when the Shah was in charge of Iran, the Shah of Iran, our policeman in the Gulf, he wanted nuclear power. And the Europeans and Americans stood on each other's shoulders to provide those facilities. Siemens, the German company, actually put its money into the Bushehr nuclear facility, which exists now. And at one point, the Shah went to New York and said on CBS, we would like an atom bomb. And when asked why, well, the Americans and the Russians have one, he said. And then he went on and met Carter at the White House, who referred to the great love, you know, your people bear you, were a great supporter of Iran. Now, when the Islamic Revolution took place in 79, Ayatollah came back to Iran, and I was present when he made this speech. He said, nuclear power is the tool of the devil, and we will close it down, and the Iranians closed it down. They did not want nuclear power under Khomeini. By 1984, when Saddam Hussein, who was supported by us in his invasion of Iran, was drenching the frontline trenches of Iran with chemicals, the senior officers in the Revolutionary Guards and the army in Iran went to Khomeini and said, Saddam is using a weapon of mass destruction against us. Next time, he's going to use nuclear weapons. At that point, Khomeini said, okay, you can reopen the nuclear facilities. We have to defend the Islamic Republic. We have a situation where it was the Shah, America's ally, that wanted nuclear weapons. No objection from the Americans at that stage. It was Ayatollah Khomeini who brought the Islamic Republic into being, who closed down the nuclear facilities, and it was Saddam's use of weapons of mass destruction, in the initial case gas, provided for the most part by the Americans, but also, of course, by the Germans, and supported by the Americans in his invasion of Iran, that prompted the Iranians and Khomeini to reopen those nuclear facilities. And they are the same facilities which we're now talking about now. In the reporting, in the narrative of the story of Iran's nuclear, quote, weapons, unquote, the first half of that story, the first half of the narrative, has been snapped off. And what we're presented with is these crazy mullahs with black turbans who suddenly want to have nuclear weapons and bomb Israel. And that is not the story as it is historically in narrative form.
All right. The U.S. still saber-rattling about an invasion, a complete sort of thorough bombing of Iran. They're talking about if the Israelis don't do it, the U.S. will do it, or the Israel. What would happen if that policy prevailed, if there was a heavy
Look, whoever
bombing?
Whoever Iran, whether it be the Americans or Israel, if it happens, it is going to make America's position in Iraq untenable, because the Iranians will then really use every tool available to harm American prestige politically and militarily inside Iraq. I don't believe they're really teaching Iraqis how to make bombs. Iraqis are very good at how to make bombs. They don't need Iranian help. Most of them learned it in Iran a long time ago. But they will then go after the Americans inside Iraq. They will even be prepared to assist the Taliban, whom they loathe, against the Americans and the British inside Afghanistan. There is no doubt that there will be a conflict between Hezbollah, which is the long arm of Iran, against Israel, America's ally, in southern Lebanon or inside Israel itself, with missiles, presumably. Missiles which, according to the Hezbollah, can now hit Israeli aircraft. In other words, Israel would lose its air cover over Lebanon, which is about the only kind of military strength it has over Lebanon. So we would see, in all these areas, a vast increase in violence against Western powers. Now, if Israel decides it wants to bomb some supposed nuclear facilities in Iran, it can run away back, you know, the Air Force can return to Israel and sit there and let the Americans take. But this will create an extraordinary incendiary situation in which Americans will have to start saying, if Israel does the bombing, what the hell are we doing with Israel? How do we get into this situation? If America performs military operations of this kind, and people like Seymour Hersh, whom I respect, whom I know is a friend of mine, say they will, then what we've seen so far, which is a hell disaster, to quote Winston Churchill about Palestine in 1947, will be much worse. I have to say that, you know, I don't think Seymour Hersh is right. I don't think there will be a strike at Iran. But I have also to say that in 2002, Seymour Hersh told me that the Americans were going to invade Iraq, and I told him he was wrong. And he was right, and I was wrong.
All right. Two more questions. First of all, how would you evaluate, we keep hearing about a successful surge in Iraq and how it needs to be expanded to be effective.
Listen, even the case of the Americans are taking fire in the press. There's always a surge or a spike in violence or a surge in violence or a surge in American troops. Iraq's problems can only be solved politically. And at the end of the day, we as military forces have got to get out of the Middle East. My calculation is that in terms of persons on the ground, we now have 22 times as many Western military forces on the ground in the Muslim world as the Crusaders had in the 12th century. Why are we there? Why are we always coming to offer democracies and freedoms, and we always arrive with our Humvees and our M1A1 Abrams tanks and our horses and our swords and our Humvees and our Apache helicopters? What the hell are we doing? We must leave militarily the Middle East. We do not have a mission here. Why are we here? I don't know, Dennis. Tell me.
I'm talking to you just for that reason, and I want to conclude this interview. We don't hear very much except lately about what's going on in Afghanistan. We've heard in the last couple of weeks about a series of bombing massacres from the United States and the West. We've heard about the resurgence of the Taliban, and we heard about expanded support from Pakistan. Please help us understand this.
Look, the Pakistanis all along have been supporting the Taliban, and they will continue to do so. The intelligence services of Pakistan are not only impregnated with pro-Taliban officials, they have always, from the start, wanted to use the Taliban in order to control Afghanistan, just as they used the Mujahideen before that against the Russians. And because of common interests from time to time, those members of the pro-Taliban area of the ISI, the Services Intelligence Authorities in Pakistan, have common cause with the United States. At other times, they are against the United States, which is why you have the crazy situation now where America is supposed to be a friend of Pakistan, while America's satrap president in Afghanistan, Mr. Hamid Karzai, is accusing Pakistan of being against and opposing and using military force via the Taliban against his government. Afghanistan is a trap for every Western army that has ever entered it in history. Whether you go right back to Greek history, or you want to go Alexander the Great, or you want to do the British in 1842, the massacre in the Kabul Gorge, the greatest defeat of British arms to that date, whether you talk about the 1892 Afghan War, the terrible British defeat at Mewand in Helmand Province, exactly the same place where the British are being defeated yet again today. You see these lone British outposts overwhelmed in the 1890s, just as the Americans were almost overwhelmed at that outpost on the Pakistani border a few days ago, 15 Americans wounded, 9 Americans dead. And still we don't learn. We don't read history books, and if we read them, we don't pay attention to them. The British managed to fight a war in 1919, the Third Afghan War, which they more or less won. They had air power, but they didn't conquer Afghanistan. And the Russians didn't manage it. And we're not going to manage it. And at the end of the day, we can go on talking about the old cliches of foreign fighters, porous borders, all the other rubbish. Taliban, most of them, are Pashtun, and they live either in Afghanistan or in the other part of what they would call Pashtunistan, which is inside Pakistan. And they are the local people. And we call them foreigners, and we talk about porous borders, a border which most of the people who live in Pakistan and Afghanistan don't even accept the government. The Durand Line, which was put down there at the time of the British Empire, which doesn't really exist except in the minds of Westerners and the various governments which we support in the region. In America, I don't think these messages are getting across. I don't think this historical reality is there. But we do seem to be rather good at blowing up wedding parties, don't we, in various parts of Afghanistan?
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, this is the stuff that's going to reverberate. You yourself were beaten brutally as a result of a lot of anger against the West.
Because of a thick air raid by B-52s, which killed the families of the people who attacked me. That was a direct result of Americans killing innocent civilians, and they continue to do so, and so do the British. And if you call in airstrikes in civilian areas where guerrillas are operating, you will kill civilians. And there's no point in saying, oh, we're going to have another inquiry into it. They're always having inquiries. And very often we don't even hear the results of the inquiries, but the truth of the matter is they kill civilians. And that's the end of the story. They do. Oh, they kill the Taliban too, and the Taliban don't care.
All right. We have been speaking with Robert Fisk. He is in a restaurant in Beirut, London, Beirut, Lebanon.
Why don't you count the restaurant in Beirut, London? I don't think you're either. Even talking to Robert Fisk in Beirut? I think Beirut, London doesn't go down too well.
For saying that, this dinner's on me. Please send me the check and I'll send me the bill and I'll put the check in the mail, Robert.
Bye-bye, Dennis.
All right. Bye.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Well, everywhere is war. This your war. Until there's no longer first class nor second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance to the color of his eyes.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. And given the situation around Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and the collapse of the Indy Bank in Southern California, we decided it was crucial that we have an emergency segment of Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz, our translator from Wall Street to Main Street. Catherine Austin Fitz helps us understand what is happening to us, even as it is happening, and oftentimes before it is happening. Catherine Austin Fitz, welcome back to Flashpoint.
Hi, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you back with us. You're sort of never wrong about any of these things. Let me just read some headlines from today. This is coming out of the Financial Times. U.S. loans rescue passes its first test. That's interesting. And I like this language. Let me read a little bit from the Times of London today. The headline is U.S. Treasury to spend billions in bailout of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The U.S. government took dramatic steps to prop up America's financial system last night, announcing that it was prepared to pump billions of dollars into the country's mortgage market in a desperate measure to prevent the economy going into a tailspin. In a late-night announcement designed to calm increasing panic on Wall Street before today's market opening, the U.S. Treasury Department and Federal Reserve issued a joint statement in which they pledged to spend billions of dollars of taxpayers, of taxpayers' money to bail out the two American mortgage giants that collectively underpin the entire housing market. If needed, of course, they're saying. The Fed said it would offer cheap financing to the giants, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, through its so-called discount window. The Treasury separately said it would propose to Congress that lines of credit to the two should be extended temporarily. The two groups together account for more than half of America's 12,000 billion outstanding mortgages. A failure of Freddie and Fannie would drive up payments significantly as a crucial source of financing and would have a domino effect across the debt market, affecting everything from car loans to student loans. Okay, Catherine, again, the thumbnail sketch of what Freddie and Fannie are, and then tell us about the dangers and what are the ramifications if these two go down.
What Freddie and Fannie do is make it possible for people who want to invest in securities to buy into pools of mortgage. So let's say we have mortgage brokers and bankers all across the country. They'll originate a pool of mortgages, and then Fannie and Freddie will either guarantee them or buy them in a mechanism where some of them can then be sold to our pension funds or sold to bond funds that we all have in our 401ks or IRAs, you know, that we can invest into our brokerage account. So they pull mortgages in a way that can then be turned into securities. And so security buyers can invest in mortgages. And what that does, Dennis, is that's enabled us to literally take American mortgages and sell them very broadly. And so you have investors all over the world who really don't want to know the details of mortgages and all the complexity of it, just be able to buy what they think of as highly secure liquid investments. And literally what we saw last week is a moment come when those investments could stop being liquid or secure. And so what we're seeing is the Treasury and the Federal Reserve take steps to try and preserve both the value of the debt securities and the liquidity. One of the other things Freddie and Fannie do is they have built up a fairly significant derivative portfolio on top of their traditional businesses, and that's a portfolio we don't understand. One of our questions here is yet, you know, do we have another example of a derivative meltdown, you know, being wagged by the tail with these crazy derivatives?
We hear this phrase, Freddie and Fannie are mama and papa mortgage people, get to go to the discount window at the Fed.
Right.
What
imagine,
does that mean to us?
Right. Imagine if you lost your job or I lost my job and the American government said, don't worry about it. We're going to let you borrow at the Fed window for 2% and you can take the money you borrow and lend it back to the Treasury at a higher rate. And so every day, all day long, you can just print profits from your investment operation and you can fund your needs every day by this financing mechanism. Can you imagine? That's essentially what they're doing. They're setting it up so that Freddie and Fannie can borrow money from the Fed and then proceed to invest it in the markets, in the long-term market. It's a backdoor way of creating profits for a company and ensuring that it has plenty of liquidity.
And it's also a backdoor way of sucking the equity out of communities all over the country to pay for the go-go operations.
In essence, yes, because by fixing things for a few players in the system, you basically print money, then it costs more for citizens or the government to borrow money, and that creates these essentially rising food prices, rising energy prices, falling dollar. So it's an inflationary effect that benefits a few, and the rest of the people who are unprotected have an inflation tax. It's a backdoor tax, ultimately.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a special edition of Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. We're talking about what's happening with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And this headline, interesting headline here from CNN, bad week ahead for banks. Analysts expect more write-downs from Citibank, Citi, and Merrill. The Indy Mac failure and problems with Fannie and Freddie. Okay, Indy Mac Bank went down in California. This is amazing, isn't it, Catherine? I believe 10,000 people lost a good chunk of their savings when that bank closed its doors last week. And there was, although we didn't hear much about it, a bit of a panic, and there is a great concern that the combination of that bank and other banks that are expected to fail in the context of Fannie Mae is going to be a big wave of trouble very soon. What does all this mean together?
Well, let me step back for a second. You and I talked about the Bear Stearns deal. Let me give you a sense of magnitude. At the end of last year, New York State has five pension funds, three big ones in New York City and two in the state. If you just look at New York teachers, and I have this up on the blog when we did Bear Stearns, at the end of last year, the New York teachers had $44 million invested in Bear Stearns stock and $50 million in Bear Stearns debt securities. If you compare that to how much it has in Fannie and Freddie, they have $183 million. Five times the equity, maybe 100 times the debt. Now, what does this mean? It means in every pension fund in the country and many of the 401ks and IRAs that are invested in some money markets and mutual funds, we're talking about arguably the largest name present in across the board. What we're talking about is a triple whammy, because when the housing bubble bursts, the houses in my community go down. But in addition, my pension fund and retirement savings go down with them.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we rarely open up the switchboard, but we want to get good questions from the audience. We know that everybody is thinking about this in different ways. We know that people listening to this broadcast either lost their money, were put in jeopardy by the failure of Indy Mac, have their money in Washington Mutual. I'm reading here, Catherine, by the way, that Wells Fargo is going to have some problems here. Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, we're talking about some significant problems. So see if we can use the expertise of Catherine Austin Fitz, which is a real gift in this context.
Well, one of the things that the growth of Freddie and Fannie have done is to centralize tremendously the governance of the mortgage system in this country. You know, the time has really come when it behooves all of us to get with our good local bankers and say, how can we start to build liquidity locally? And what is it we can do in our community to start to help support housing prices and the transfer and ownership of housing here? The communities that are going to do well in this environment, Dennis, are the ones where everybody's going to come to the table and start to say, how can we get the fundamental economics here to work right in a healthy way for all parties? Now, because Freddie and Fannie have traditionally had certain benefits of being a government-sponsored enterprise, and a lot of benefits and status that come along with that, including lines of credit from the Treasury in a meaningful amount, they have traditionally traded in the market as though they had an indirect guarantee of the government. And, of course, the question is, if this time ever came and they were in danger, would the government step up and back them and do whatever was necessary to make sure they're protected? So the market seems to be believing that the Treasury and the Fed are going to do whatever they can to make sure that the debt securities on these two agencies are liquid.
We're speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz. She is the founder of Solari.com. She's a financial advisor, a former Wall Street banker, a partner at Dillon & Reed, a high-level official in the first Bush administration at HUD.
As a matter of disclosure, I should confess that I'm a former member of the Fannie Mae Advisory Board, which was chaired by Angela Mazzello, who I knew there.
And
I was their regulator. As Assistant Secretary of Housing, I helped regulate Fannie and Freddie.
I would really like some women to call. We're open to all sexes, all three or four of them. But, you know, I know in my house, it was my mom who had to figure out how to balance the checkbook when there was no money. And I really do want to have women in this dialogue. But we'll start with Matt in Burlingame. Do you have a very precise question or comment for Catherine Austin Fitz?
I do. I'm delighted that you have this guest whose credentials and competence are impeccable. I'm so thankful. And I have a slightly different perspective that I wanted to share. You know, ma'am, you stated that the effect of this catastrophe, and we are falling off a cliff in slow motion, will be inflationary. I disagree. I believe that so much wealth is being wiped off the books of everybody that we face profoundly deflationary implications. And I'd like your comment.
I agree, because we're watching two things. That we're watching the money supply with these bailouts be increased dramatically to fight deflation, and we're getting two effects. We're getting huge deflation on asset prices in most sectors, but we're getting incredible inflation on expenses. So the average family is experiencing extraordinary inflation on their food, on their oil. They're suffering from a falling dollar as a result of sort of the last 10 years of what's been going on. But I agree with you, and I think the chances of deflation have been steadily increasing.
Lisa in Oakland, you're on the air with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Hi, I was just wondering if you could go into a little more detail about the actual effects this will have on people, because I see the FDIC only insures accounts up to $100,000, and presumably if people start withdrawing their money, there could be a run in the bank.
Well, thank you. IndyMac, by the way, people who had over $100,000 are going to get back half of their money. So they're going to lose half of everything over $100,000. That's what they're doing down south. Catherine, did you want to take a shot?
I generally don't feel comfortable with having more than $100,000 in an FDIC-insured situation. But more importantly, I think what is very important for all of us to understand, Dennis, is we keep looking to government guarantees to make us feel safe. And as a result, the system depends on more and more government guarantees. We end up with 300 million people who say, I don't care if anything makes fundamental economic sense. I don't care if there's any productivity because I have a government guarantee. I always tell the famous story of I had dinner at the Jockey Club in 1997 with Dick Ravitch when he was chairman of AFL-CIO Housing Trust, and I was trying to persuade him of my plan to significantly improve education and jobs in communities. He looked at me and he said, as long as I get government guarantees, what do I care if people have education or jobs? We have got to convert back to a society that cares. Because if we don't, we can guarantee everything, you know, on the planet, but the reality is, at some point, the U.S. military cannot force everybody to buy more Treasury securities to keep our guarantee system going.
Let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. You are on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Oh, hi, Dennis. Thanks. Hey, I would be a woman if I wasn't a man, so let me say that at the time of my call. So, I guess my simple question is, in what is your guest opinion? What is the exposure of banks, major banks? You mentioned Washington Mutual, Wells Fargo. What, in her opinion, is the you know, the dangerous exposure of having IndyMac kind of situation happen in a large bank like that?
Well, there are a couple of issues. One is for any bank that has a large derivative portfolio, which are the larger banks, you could get in a situation where the only thing that keeps them going is basically the Fed's willing to pump. But if you set those banks aside and you say, okay, let's just look at the banks that have fundamental true banking business as opposed to financial speculation, then the issue for those banks is they're operating in a community or communities and cultures that is all dollar-based. And if we see a real flight or destruction of the dollar and people don't want to hold dollars, you know, they all are going to have problems. And that really comes down to a fundamental confidence in the integrity, both ethically, legally, and financially in the system. And so here's the question. Do we believe that we are part of a legal system that is trustworthy and lawful? And part of the breakdown you're seeing is more and more discomfort globally that the American system is one that's fundamentally sane. You cannot have this kind of financial meltdown unless a system has a level of systemic fraud which brings into question the fundamental integrity of the legal system and the culture.
And if you could do it in three lines, Catherine, how would you describe the fraud?
The fraud is the primary source of profit in the system. Most mortgages in this country, and this goes to the question of leadership, were fraudulently induced. When I encourage a whole society to take out debt, and this is not just subprime debt, this is across the board the whole society. When I encourage people to borrow a whole bunch of money without warning them as to what's coming, you know, globally, that's going to shift their income and their situation, and I don't warn them and help them prepare, then I've abdicated my leadership responsibility.
All right. Let's go to Janet in Berkeley. You're on with Catherine Austin Fetz.
Yeah. I have my entire life savings in two banks, Wachovia and Washington Mutual, in short-term CDs. You know, one, are these banks going to hold? And, you know, how good is the guarantee of the FDIC? Or is it time to take my money out and bury it in the garden?
Well, I would really encourage you to, up on my blog, there is a post that I put up approximately 2 weeks ago called Positioning Your Assets. And I would really encourage you to read it, because what it describes is if you've held your assets in dollars or CDs or any other fixed income security denominated in dollars, if you held your money in that form for the last 5 years, in effect, you've lost 50% of your value. I think it's time for you to take some serious time to study this, and I would just recommend we have tremendous audio seminars to help you with just this kind of thing.
Catherine, I want to thank you very much, because the situation is so important and people need to know a great deal more about their finances and the impact they can have on their own communities by taking control of their finances. Catherine, thanks. Solari.com, thank you.
Like to live in a wigwam. I'd like to live in a wigwam. I'd like to live in a wigwam and dance round the totem pole. I'd like to live in an igloo. I'd like to live in an igloo. I'd like to live in an igloo and fish from an ice hole. Oh, I'd like to ride on a caravan. I'd like to take a ride on a caravan. Yes, I'd like to ride on a caravan and sing with the gypsies. I'd like to live on a commune. Yes, I'd like to live on a commune. Yes, I'd like to live on a commune. And people who call me a hippie.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today we are hoping to welcome back to this broadcast former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. She's now running for the president on the Green Party ticket. McKinney says, quote, "We have to do things we've never done before in order to have things we've never had before." In a moment, we'll also be joined by Rosa Clemente, who is running along with McKinney as her vice presidential running mate. You may remember that it was on this broadcast, Flashpoints, that Cynthia McKinney announced her analysis on the 9/11 attacks and what was happening within the Bush administration around that. This program was rebroadcast around the world, quoted in the Washington Times and the Washington Post on the same day, and then she lost her congressional seat. We do want to present to you this marvelous clip of her accepting the Green Party nomination for the President of the United States.
Women are still the overwhelming profile of the minimum wage worker in this country. 65% of all minimum wage workers are women, according to 2005 statistics. Despite the law, women still go to work every day, performing the same tasks as men, yet bring home less pay than their male counterparts. Asian American and Pacific Island women make 88 cents for every dollar earned by men. But African American women earn only 72 cents, and my Latina sisters earn only 60 cents for every dollar earned by men. Overall, according to 2007 statistics, women with similar education, skills, and experience are paid 77 cents for every dollar a man makes. Equal pay for equal work is not yet a reality for working women in this country, and the glass ceiling is all too real. I'm very proud of my second cousin, Shante, whose mother, a divorcee, raised her pretty much as a single mom. Shante's mother, Shara, understood the value of her child getting a good education and helped her as much as she could with university tuition. The rest, Shante was able to secure by working on campus and with student loans. Shante graduated from college and then took a one-year master's program in social work, and now she wants to get her PhD, but she's already over $90,000 in debt. It doesn't have to be this way, and it isn't this way in other countries. In other countries around the world, higher education is valued and is made affordable to all who want it. Only a sick government would place a banker in between a student and her teacher. An insurance lobbyist in between a patient and his doctor. Lying and spying before 911 truth and the Constitution. Only a sick government would place a wealthy family and their huge corporation and its genetically modified Frankenfood peddled by force in between us and the organic food that's healthy for us to eat and that farmers prefer to grow. Only a sick government would do these things. I am no longer willing to trust the ones who are responsible for getting us into this mess to provide the solution to get us out of it. The Green Party long ago took a stand for racial justice, against profiling, against police brutality, against discrimination of any sort, and for reparations stemming from the transatlantic slave trade. The Green Party long ago took a stand for gender equity. The Green Party is a justice party, and a green vote is a justice vote. And the day after the election, if voters have been disfranchised and don't believe the announced election results, it will be the Green Party that will be there, as it was in 2004, to demand election integrity. It is for all these reasons and more that I redeclare my goals in the language of the sisters who convened at Seneca Falls 160 years ago. They wrote, "It is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their security." That declaration not only avoids the politics of the past, it contains a kernel for the future. How can those new guards be secured? Here's how. When I was first running for Congress, and it was the year of the woman, women all over the country were saying, "We want our seat at the table." And when I got to Washington, I saw that public policy is really made in a room at a table. There were real seats at the table. Well, imagine, what has happened to public policy making now. There is a real room with a window and a door, and there's two seats at the table. The window is for us to look through while our representatives make policy for us so we can see what they're doing. At the table, one seat is for the Democrats, one seat is for the Republicans. Now, we don't know who did it, but one of them put a lock on the door and slipped a key to the corporate lobbyists who can come and go at will and whisper what they want to Democrats and Republicans. And the result is that we, the people who pay for those seats and determine who sits in them, want one thing. But because the corporate lobbies can come and go at will, our values get overridden and our representatives give us something else.
We are delighted that we managed to track her down, and we've got Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney now running for the President of the United States. Cynthia McKinney, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis. I am so happy to be with you, even though we're on a massive road trip up the Northeast Corridor.
Well, we want to speak with you from every corner and every nook and cranny in this country. Take us along on the ride. What has this trip meant to you so far?
It has given me the opportunity to visit 24 states. I've seen a lot of this country. I've seen a lot of the hope. I've seen a lot of the despair. I've seen intense and fierce patriotism. And so what our challenge is to remove the fear and remove the doubt that people are experiencing right now. What's wrong with people in the United States that they are not able to use the power of their ballot in the same way that people in Mexico, Brazil, and Venezuela, Nicaragua, Ecuador have been able to use the power of their ballot in order to achieve a really a silent revolution?
That is the voice of Cynthia McKinney. She is running for president on the Green Party. Her running mate is activist visionary Rosa Clemente. Rosa Clemente, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis.
How would you distinguish yourself a little bit, say, from Dick Cheney?
Wow. Well, first, I'm running for his job. Second, I won't ever be in jail for war crimes.
I was horrified, Cynthia McKinney, to see Barack Obama make the comment that the death penalty is okay sometimes. I can imagine Martin Luther King coming back and trying to explain to Barack Obama the nature of injustice. Do you want to talk about the death penalty as a cutting-edge issue in terms of criminal justice and human rights?
Many of the visionaries of our past who helped to create the environment that we take for granted today would be shocked to hear that in the midst of such injustice that the presumptive Democratic nominee would basically stand in line with previous Democratic nominees to say that the death penalty is okay.
And Rosa Clemente.
Well, I mean, for my generation and the ones coming up right behind us, the number one pressing domestic issue after employment and education is obviously the prison industrial complex. And I come from a generation that the war on drugs has been a war on youth of color up until the recent shooting of Sean Bell and hundreds of unarmed black and Latino men in this country, particularly when we know that the death penalty is racist. I mean, there's been hundreds of reports. There's been how many people taken off death row after DNA testing. We know it's inherently a racist system, and for Barack Obama to support it indicates again where the Democratic Party has gone, completely moderating to the right and pretty soon to be the new right in this country.
Well, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, let's change the subject now and focus on the wars. Afghanistan is right back up to a hot war. We've got Iraq and the possibility of Iran. What would you do as president? How would you change history? What relationship would you develop instead of this warring relationship with the Middle East?
First of all, I would instruct the Joint Chiefs to draw up a plan to order the orderly withdrawal of all of our troops from not just Iraq and Afghanistan, but from the more than 100 bases that we have around the world. Of course, we would not countenance any kind of naval blockade of Iran. We've already got quotes from the Democratic presumptive nominee talking about bombing Iran, nuking Iran, bombing Pakistan. You know, that's a kind of macho lingo that really has no place now. We would rename and rebrand the Department of State as the Department of Peace, so that people around the world would know that there has been a wholesale change in the U.S. orientation to the rest of the world. And we would also remind our own ambassadors what they are there for.
We're seeing another wall being built by the same company building the wall between Israel and Palestine, now building a wall at the southern border. What about this war against the poor at home? What can we do about it?
Well, you can follow my example and not give our most precious political asset to a party that is totally unworthy. The Democratic Party, through its votes in the Congress, has decided to be complicit in all that the Bush administration has done, crimes against people abroad and crimes against the American people here at home, to spend $720 million every day for war and occupation. The Democratic-led Congress could have voted to provide health care through a single-payer health care system, Medicare for all. And because they chose not to do that, I choose to withhold my most precious political asset, which is my vote, from them. I am happy to vote green, to be a green, and I would love to see public policy made in this country according to Green Party values.
Thank you so much, Cynthia, for joining us, and Rosa Clemente.
Thank you, and check out our website, gpgreenparty.org.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. And music breaks this week, Bob Marley with War, and Cat Stevens, I Want to Live in a Wigwam. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.